Hello again. Welcome back, my friends. Today, if I were to tell you that we were going to talk about plush toys, that would be both factual and wildly underselling the success of the brand we're going to learn about today. I want to know everything about this. I want to walk through the story. I want to go deep. I want to hear how this happened. And because the brand we're discussing today doesn't just sell plush toys, and they've also been on Shark Tank, but they've gone be at this point. Oh, come on, Shark Tank. These Shark Tank contestants are a dime a dozen. We've had so many on the show, which is really cool. We've had a handful of folks who had TV shows, and this brand has not just a TV show coming out, a Jim Henson produced TV show, it seems. I want to hear the story. We are joined by Kelly Oryard and Kaylee Christensen, the founders of Slumberkins. And well, Kelly, Kaylee, welcome. Thank you for joining me on the unofficial Shopify podcast today.
Thank you for having us on. We're excited to share the story.
All right, Slumberkins, what is it?
Slumberkins is an emotional health and wellness brand for families. We have characters that teach different emotional skills, like everything from mindfulness to self-esteem to conflict resolution, stress relief, and even a collection for grief and loss. Kelly and I are both former educators. I'm a former special education teacher, and Kelly is a marriage and family therapist and school counselor. And we've been best friends since we were 14. So it's kind of, there's a long story behind how Slumberkins came to be.
Then let's start at the beginning. What inspired you to start Slumberkins?
We ended up serendipitously on a maternity leave at the same time. So lined up with Kaylee's second son and my first son, both working in the schools and Title I schools at the time. And while we were on maternity leave with our new babies, we were really inspired. We were going on walks and talking about, you know, the difficulties that we were seeing in the schools, which was a rise in behavior, lack of supports for mental health, not enough homeschool connection, where the skills that we were teaching as a therapist and a special ed teacher weren't connecting in the way that we wanted them to back home. And so we thought, well, maybe we can do something on our break, quote unquote, from being in the schools. And we decided to, you know, try to do something about it. So at the time, we taught ourselves to sew. We thought, let's use creatures and stories to help parents connect with their children and have these tools to support emotional learning on a deep level. Similar things to what I was probably doing in family therapy sessions, right? To help boost self-esteem or start with mindfulness, things like this. So, you know, taught ourselves to sew, wrote the first stories, and sold Slumberkins at some craft fairs in the local Pacific Northwest. And kind of just through the power of social media and community, we're able to get an intense following of people who loved the product and grew from there.
How long ago was that? What year was this when we started?
We started, that was in 2016. Well, end of 2015, early 2016.
So early on, you come up with the idea, and it's often in these entrepreneurial stories, it's pain or problem in someone's personal life. And so for the two of you, it sounds like it was professional experience that you were seeing issues that you felt you could address.
I would add, and pain and problems in our own parenting lives with our own kids and our own journeys too. It was kind of a culmination of all three.
All right. I accept that and the serendipity. How do we go from that to let's make books and plush toys to help with this?
So I think as moms and educators, we both recognized the power of story. We were doing this type of like social stories and interventions in our roles as educators. And then we also had kids that love characters and love favorite TV shows and favorite books. And we kind of just saw the opportunity to really wed the two in a new way that had never been done before. You know, a plush toy isn't innovative. A children's book isn't innovative. But what we did was created really meaningful moments of connection through our publishing, like the way that we write. Kelly, as a therapist, infused therapeutic research-backed therapeutic techniques into each storyline that then really kind of created the magic that people really felt and experienced when they read a Slumberkin story and cuddled up with that creature. And then that magic, really, our first customers are what really fueled the brand forward. All of a sudden, it wasn't us trying to figure out what to do. It was us trying to keep up with demand.
I love in these journeys when a sewing machine becomes a rapid prototyping tool. And it sounds like that would have happened here. The first plush toy, the first Slumberkin, what was it?
We did a Bigfoot and a sloth. Those were our two first ones. We're from the Pacific Northwest near Portland, Oregon. So Bigfoot, some people really believe in him out here. And it's just a really kind of fun character to play with. And to infuse the storyline, you know, our Bigfoot character stands for self-esteem. And some of his storylines are inspired by my own experience being very tall. I was 6 feet tall in sixth grade. You know, kids don't say the nicest things when you're so different. And so, you know, his storyline, Bigfoot copes with hurt feelings, comes from those painful personal experiences. And then our sloth, you know, like sloths weren't like trendy at the time. They were, but it was a fun and unique creature. And Kelly saw the opportunity to really infuse a progressive muscle relaxation routine into a storyline for a bedtime routine for kids. And so those were our two first and most popular characters. And, you know, the sewing machine was like a big part of year one. We personally hand sewed about 4,000 Slumberkins. And while we were trying to understand overseas manufacturing and production and finding the right partners, especially when you're in the world of children's toys, and especially in the world of toys or things that children sleep with. Safety and production was like a really big piece of the puzzle for us.
Absolutely. Well, how did you go about researching that or figuring it out? Like, even when you're making it yourself, it still has to be, you know, flame retardant. It has to be non-toxic. Ideally, we don't have lead in our plush toys, right? Like, how do you address it?
Yeah, I mean, early days, we were going down to our local craft stores where we were buying, you know, the fabric at Joanne Fabrics or just wherever was around town and kind of putting together. It was really handmade kind of craft project almost in the early days. But then as we were unable to keep up with demand and wanted to keep trying, I started to do research about, okay, you know, I had no experience in this. So I, you know, Googled. Who makes Disney's plush toys? Who makes IKEA plush toys? Like, who are the best going to? Because they're going to have to follow those rules and standards, which we wanted to have as well. So actually, it was like 11 pages deep on Google that I happened to run into the name of the president of a company that was based overseas, but he was in LA. And so I just took a chance, wrote him an email and said, hey, you know, I'm a teacher turned entrepreneur. I'm trying to figure out how to make plush. I'm making this here. I can't keep up. I've like bought out all of the plush in my local stores here. And I think I have something, but, you know, I'd like to make, I think I said at the time, like, you know, 1,000 with you. Could you help me? And, you know, they did work with Disney and IKEA and everything. He's like, oh, that's really sweet. We make, you know, one SKU. So one is 5,000. You have to make 5,000 of them for one SKU. And we were like, oh, so we're a little bit too small for you right now. But actually through connecting with him, and I asked if he would be a mentor or just help me as I navigated trying to figure out how to do it on a smaller scale in an ethical way. And I think just through relationship building, by the time we got to the point where we were almost about to produce with somebody else who was smaller, they weren't able to give us their certificate of compliance around like child labor laws. And he was like, don't do it. This is like a scam. I cannot watch you go down that path. And so he ended up lowering his MOQs for us and taking a chance on us. In that factory. And that person actually, then we met people behind the scenes, like the founder of Build-A-Bear, Maxine Clark, because she also was using them in production and became good friends with her. And it just opened so many doors to have the right production person. And again, that is like serendipity at its finest. Page 11 of Google.
Yeah, that's incredible. Yeah. There's so many, but so often on the show we hear, you know, he said, hey, you're going to get scammed. Like, run, don't do it. And I've done enough of these interviews, it happens a lot. Like, that's the first often, you know, the first terrible thing that occurs is issues finding and getting a manufacturer to deliver. And so I'm happy to hear you were able to avoid that. In the early days, were there any other, you know, like what was one other primary challenge you faced other than locating a manufacturer?
I would say when we appeared on Shark Tank, that was right around the time that we were still making them in the US. And actually our first shipment of, I believe it was 14,000 that we ended up getting in our first shipment over, was landing on the day we aired on Shark Tank, but they were unpackaged. We had to figure out how to package them stateside. And then we aired in November, and like November 12th or 9th or something like that. And then it was the e-commerce like holiday shipping window where we needed to quickly turn them to deliver them to families in time for the holidays. And so that was one of our like biggest, most stressful like pain point. Like we didn't have a facility that could receive pallets. Like we were still like working out of our homes. And I think we had a small office at the time that was like, you know, 800 square feet or something. And we were still like shipping them from our office as well. We were our own fulfillment partners. And so that was chaos. And we had all of our friends and family join in on the fun on hand packaging 14,000 slumberkins and shipping them out. I know Kelly and I personally missed Thanksgiving that year because we were doing customer service for Black Friday. Like it was just complete chaos. But at the same time, it was such like an amazing opportunity for us as a brand just to kind of, you know, think bigger for the brand when you're put on that scale of a platform and program over what your strategy really is moving forward.
So, well, absolutely. Tell me about that Shark Tank experience. Did you get funded through Shark Tank?
No, we didn't even get an offer. We went in thinking, gosh, of course we're going to get an offer. We're going to win. And our only experience in business at the time was literally watching Shark Tank. So we watched every episode before we went there. We went in confident. We quit our jobs before we got there because we were like, they're going to ask us if we're committed. We have to be true and honest that we totally are committed. And then, yeah, we went in and I remember one of the things they asked us. So one of the things when we watched the show was we saw a lot of people get attacked for being wishy-washy when they were talking with the sharks, right? Like they said one thing and then the shark said something and then they kind of waffled. And then people would go out. So we were like, whatever we say, even if we don't know that that's fully true, we're going to just be really confident about it. We're going to be like, yep, that's what we're doing. And we know exactly what we're doing, even though we had no idea what we were doing. So they asked us, well, you're doing direct to consumer now. What's your plan for growth? And we were so early in that time, but we were like, we want to go mass. We're going to go mass. We want to get to more families. We want to get to spread this mission. And I remember Mark Cuban saying, well, you know, you're going to have to decide, is it the money or the mission? And I remember being like, it's the mission. And so it was like made us look really like, oh, these nice teachers. But then the next day after Shark Tank that we filmed, Toys R Us went under. All retail was like going down. Like we weren't super aware of that, but all of the sharks were. So they were like, yeah, no, we're out. We're not going to support you with your crazy idea to go to, you have something going good for DTC and you're going to switch to mass. Like that doesn't make sense. So everybody went out.
Well, all right. So your experience is not unusual. I mean, most people don't get the offer. And even when they do, like the due diligence comes after the show. And you know this, but the due diligence comes after the show. And then often it falls through there. I don't know that I've interviewed somebody or talked to somebody that like actually got, you know, the investment through the show. But I mean, the real magic is the experience, the exposure, the legitimacy, and the bump every time the rerun airs. Do you see it like in your traffic? You're like, oh, rerun must have aired.
Yeah, we do. I'll randomly like look and see spikes and I can attribute it to re-airing. Or if I know that we're re-airing, I'll look and we'll still get, and people consume media so differently these days. You know, like people are still watching our season for the first time just because they're watching it on Hulu. And so like we get DMs all the time that it's like, oh, I just saw you guys on Shark Tank. I'm so glad you guys are still around. Like they really missed out. Like we still, I think, win over the consumers even 9 years, almost like 8 years later now.
As we ring in the new year, did you know that over 90% of Shopify merchants won't hit their maximum revenue in 2024? Ugh! That's because they're killing their conversion rates by using outdated landing page designs and default templates. You work hard all year, and you deserve to realize your dream of owning a successful store. But without the right tools, it's like running a marathon with lead weights tied to your feet. That's where Zipify Pages comes in. Zipify Pages is the game-changing landing page builder created by the founder of a $180 million Shopify store. It has everything you need to transform your store into a high-converting, sales-generating machine. Zipify Pages' intuitive builder, mobile-optimized templates, and AI-powered features are helping thousands of Shopify stores boost their conversion rates and run more profitable marketing campaigns. Zipify Pages improves every page on your Shopify store. Just select a template from their template library and then quickly customize it to match your brand. You can easily create better product pages, landing pages, category pages, even home pages. And because every Zipify template is tested on their $180 million Shopify store, you know they actually work. So don't let 2024 drift by with unmet revenue goals. Upgrade your store today with Zipify Pages and make this your best new year yet. Go to zipify.com/curd to start a free 14-day trial. That's zipify.com/KURT to try Zipify Pages for free. So I always do this when someone says they're on Shark Tank. I Google like brand name Shark Tank and I check to see, do you have a Shark Tank landing page on your site? And I don't think you do. It totally missed opportunity. Make a page for those viewers where you're like, oh, you know, talk about your experience. Sometimes if you're lucky, you could embed like a clip from the episode and then, you know, then it's like, oh, and you know, if you want to learn more, here's our products, our collection. Hopefully to get them to then browse it.
That's a great idea. I haven't thought about like how to continue to leverage it other than just the inbound traffic that we see from it. But that's great.
Yeah, just a little quick SEO win for like the small community of Shark Tank attendees. When you think about your target market, in your head, who is it? Who's the ideal customer? Because it's like, you know, it's a unit. It's potentially multiple people.
Well, so this is where I think founder market fit really kind of helps us. I mean, we typically market to overwhelmed parents, which we are. I have three kids. Kelly has two. Like, we're very much like in it. And so it's a natural voice and brand message where we can really kind of position our brand as, I mean, we are users of our own products as well. And, but right now I think if we had to like name our like target personas that we've identified as a brand, it's like a big segment of overwhelmed moms. Another segment of kind of like first time, like super learner parents, like people that just want to do everything like perfectly for their first child. And then we know that if they have a second, they become the overwhelmed mom very quickly. But yeah, I mean, our primary demo is like millennial and Gen Z parents.
You know, I should have asked earlier. Slumberkins, it's a fantastic name. Was that always the name? Did you start with that? How did you come up with it?
Actually, we started because we were doing craft fairs. It was sort of me and Kaylee, you know, doing just different products. Like we had at our first craft fair, we had sewn what we were calling Slumberland creatures at the time. So those were our Slumberkins. So slumber was always part of the name because it was like a bedtime routine that we came up with the plush. But we also had, you know, nursing scarves and decor. We were just like going on this crafting project for these fairs. And so our name at the time was Spoon and Moon. So Kaylee's last name was Spooner. So that was like Spoon, and my partner called me Luna. So it was like Spoon and Moon. We thought, oh, that's a cute little baby brand. And these are our Slumberland creatures. But then we saw that the creatures were the things that were selling. So we're like, okay, wow, we have something here. We could drop the nursing scarves. and we went to look up like, oh, could we get that name? And that is actually owned by Disney. So we were like, whoa, okay, that's not going to work. So we started just brainstorming around what are we doing? Like what are we trying to go for here? And we landed on Slumberkins with a whole bunch of the other funny ideas now that we look back, because I think we really landed on the perfect name. Although sometimes it doesn't express the fullness of what's underneath the surface with all of our creatures and the mental health and emotional wellness side. People just really hear Slumberkins and feel that comfort and connection and cuddling. which is great too.
It is a good brand name. And it's one of those where it's like, it feels right. But when you hear it, you're like, I got to know more. Like there's an air of curiosity to it. I love that early on you start with in-person events. I hear this a lot talking to entrepreneurs as they do in-person events because it makes a very impactful connection. Depending on where you live, in-person marketplaces can be quite accessible. Certainly me in the Chicago suburbs, there are several I like to go to. And you get to connect to people face-to-face and help develop word of mouth and get feedback. Early on, did you feel that? Were you like, in a potentially unintentional iterative product development cycle, just going to those fairs and meeting the same people over and over?
Absolutely. I mean, the feedback was the thing that I think fueled us forward. People, and to this day, when our brand is at any sort of trade show, we get lots of criers in the booths because the moment someone reads the storylines, it connects with them in such a deep way because what's embedded in the storylines is really a lot of like inner child, like healing narrative and work that adults never heard as a child. And then it gives the parents that tool and that script from a family therapist to then read and kind of parent their children in a different way than all of us that were raised in the 80s or 90s, like didn't receive just because, and it's not that our parents didn't, they didn't do anything wrong. It the conversation around mental and emotional health wasn't, there's so much less stigma around it now. Now it's like, yes, proactively we build these skills instead of waiting until something's really wrong to address it.
It makes me feel like I should be purchasing some of these books for myself. You're starting in markets. At what point do you start the Shopify store? When do you start selling online?
We actually started on Etsy first because it just made it easy. I mean, we were educators turned entrepreneurs. We just needed the
easiest way
to market. Yeah. And then we waited. Once we knew we were going to change the name to Slumberkins, because we did our diligence of filing trademark before we launched with it. And, that's something that really early on, because we were working part-time in the schools for the first like 18 months, we didn't pay ourselves anything from any revenue we made. We invested it all into either purchasing more fabric and or IP protection. So we, to the point on sewing machines and prototypes, like we got design patent awards on our like character designs and also like early trademark protection, which down the road has benefited us so much in the world of IP licensing, like in our deal with the Jim Henson Company that, you mentioned the show, it streams on Apple, like all of that, had we not laid that foundation, either wouldn't have happened or it would have been a different scenario for us.
There would be a Jim Henson show that's like suspiciously similar, but not the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly.
I mean, it's crazy. Even back in like 2019, there was a blatant knockoff that ended up appearing at like TJ Maxx. And when we sent a cease and desist and showed that we had proof of a design patent, they took them down, stopped selling, and said they were actually surprised that we had that type of protection. But we were able to stop it.
As in they weren't counting on you to have it.
Yeah, no, they weren't. So it's benefited us for sure as a brand and just like protecting the characters, which, goes back to, we started out as teachers and moms wanting to provide tools that just made like bedtime more meaningful, more intentional, helped proactively have these conversations around emotions and meeting kids' emotional needs to really help prevent some of the things that we were seeing in the schools with school-aged kids. And what we didn't really realize in the early days was that like what we were really creating was some really valuable IP in the form of character IP that now that the brand is built and we have the 15 core characters, each character has almost its own platform around the different themes that they stand for and can be leveraged in the world of licensing and IP and content in so many different ways that it truly, like we're almost 9 years in and some days it feels like we're just getting started.
This pivotal business decision to get those trademarks, to make sure this is formally, you formally own the IP for these characters, and early on, you can't picture what's going to happen. And so it just feels like this is this is a thing I know I'm supposed to do as a potential business owner here. And then, you know, down the road, you want to go back in time and thank yourself, it seems.
Yeah, I think that's also just founders, the other entrepreneurs and founders that we meet. It's a certain type of person. They're a little bit crazy. You regular people look at what you're doing and they're like, why? This is really weird. If you're not on the edge of people judging you and feeling like what you're doing is a little crazy or weird, you're probably not doing enough. Because really, I remember getting that first patent. The lawyer was like, I mean, sure, we can get a design patent on this if you want to pay me, you know? And I remember my mom saying, I don't know, guys, this is really weird. Are you sure you want to do this? This is flubby, flat, you know, animal. Like, what is this? And I think we were so passionate about it and seeing people respond and having the experiences that they were, there was just no stopping us. We just were like, nope, this is how it goes. We have to get it protected. We're going to, someday we'll have a TV show. And we did say that on Shark Tank and they laughed at us. So that was another one where they're like, yeah, that's what everybody says. And we were like, but we're going to do it.
And yet you were on TV with them, yeah, right? And you did get that TV show.
Yeah.
How did that happen? How did you get the show?
So we were at a conference called the Altitude Summit, the Alt Summit, that is for kind of creative entrepreneurs and design. And it's really like geared towards women. And we ended up at a sponsored dinner and we ended up sitting at the same table as the president of television for the Jim Henson Company. And we had done our diligence to know that they were going to be there or that she was going to be there. And so we were just hoping and wishing and praying that we had like an opportunity to speak to her. And that dinner was it. But to back up for a second, I'm leaving out the piece that's crucial to this story. When we appeared on Shark Tank, we did see a bump in revenue, enough so where Kelly and I said, okay, let's take like $15,000 of that increase of bump in revenue of cash that we just got, and let's invest it in YouTube. Like, let's invest it in making a puppet and content, and like, let's try to bring one of our characters to life and see if we can do something ourselves on YouTube. So we had a friend build a puppet, but we gave him the money to do it. You know, like he built a set in his garage, and we like filmed three like puppet, Bigfoot puppet YouTube videos. And we learned a lot of lessons. We learned how expensive it is to make content. And then we also had the prototypes of our puppet. We had the like concept. We had the vision that like these things can come to life. So that in that moment when we met Hallie, the president of television at the Altitude conference, we were like, oh my gosh, look at what we're making. And she was like, what? It's a puppet? Like, we need to talk more. And I love the mission. At the time she was a single mom and she had a child that had anxiety. And so she really just connected with the mission and what we were doing. And it really became relationship based where, you know, we went out to dinner with her at the conference the next evening. And like at that dinner table, she was like, let's do this. Let's make a show. And Kelly and I are like sitting at the table, kicking each other underneath the table, just not even knowing if this is real. And it wasn't until we got back to the Portland area back home and like the next week we were like, okay, let's get on a call. Let's see what we need to do to like actually make this happen. And I just remember exactly where we were standing in my house at the time when she goes, no, girls, like this is happening. Like I'm the person you need to talk to. Like you don't have to pitch to anyone. Like we're just going to do this together. And so we kind of we have a very unique process, you know, like that's not how it goes for a lot of people to get a show made. And so it, for us, it just comes back to relationship, serendipity, the timing, also the grit and tenacity around like the work that we had put in to even get to the prototype and vision of it. So
it is easy to dismiss your success as they got lucky. But when you just keep getting lucky over and over, it's not luck anymore, right? It's you have created a scenario, and there's a term for this. I heard a TED talk called a luck sale, and I've been obsessed with this concept for years since. That the culmination of these decisions, of your actions, of the things you're doing, and you know the energy that you're putting out into the world and making people aware of what you're doing and what you are hoping to get is what creates these opportunities. And man, did it ever pay off for you? This is just incredible.
Yeah, thank you. We have a group of entrepreneurial friends that will joke around in the early days. They would joke around and say we were like the Mr. Beans of business because we would just like come back to the meeting and be like, and guess what's happening now?
They're like, no, I just like, don't even. Yeah, they're like, I don't even want to hear it anymore. Oh, you just stumbled in and now you have a TV show. Oh, you were selling these and now you found the best manufacturer. But I also just think too, it's like what we were saying. We've always been authentic and open and just ourselves and willing to kind of look like crazy people because we were in it together. So we would always say, okay, well, even though this is scary and strange or weird or people don't get what we're doing, like we get what we're doing. And so we like pump each other up. And I think that's helped us like keep driving forward when I think other entrepreneurs or solo entrepreneurs, sometimes you lose your confidence or you feel like, oh man, maybe I need to go get my MBA or go to business school because this isn't working, you know, like that there's someone who's going to answer or be able to help you do it. But I think that it's just that tenacity and like willingness to put yourself out there and fail a lot.
Yeah, it is. You're right. I mean, you're going to get punched in the face. It's just accepting that you'll have to dust yourself off and then do it again. And as long as you could keep doing that, you get somewhere eventually.
You thought that would end at some point, like maybe once we like got to this some sort of status in place with the business that we would stop like turning around corners and getting punched in the face. Let me give you a little hint. It never stops.
Yeah, just new different problems.
This episode is sponsored in part by Cleverific. How many times have you had to deal with the headache of a customer needing to change their order after it's been placed? Isn't it a hassle to manually adjust order details like shipping addresses or pant sizes? Well, what if I told you that those days could be over? That's where Cleverific comes in. With Cleverific, you can empower your customers to make their own changes through a self-service portal, or make it easier for your team to handle those complex adjustments directly from the back end. Peter Manning, New York, cut their order support queries by a staggering 99% after integrating Cleverific. And they're not alone. Cleverific is designed to reduce customer support tickets, ship orders faster, and even reduce returns and lost packages. Listeners of this show get 50% off Cleverific's Pro plan, dropping your cost to just $49 a month with full access to all of their features. Just go to cleverific.com/unofficial and use the promo code podcast50 at checkout to claim your discount. Streamline your operations with Cleverific, dramatically cut down on customer support inquiries, expedite shipping, and minimize returns. Cleverific.com/unofficial.
I really don't have a ton of experience selling families, children, and parents. Is this a competitive market?
Yeah, it's very competitive. I mean, the toy industry by nature is one of the most competitive spaces out there, you know, like, but that's more the traditional toy industry where they're fighting for kind of aisle space. And I personally love the documentary on Netflix called The Toys That Made Us because it goes into the history of the competitiveness of the industry. And that's where I think being direct to consumer really kind of set us apart in the early days because we didn't rely on retail to sell our products. And we also were able to build connection with the consumer with that direct one-to-one relationship and really build an online community. You know, you mentioned, you know, the big thing that happened to everybody in 2020, you know, when COVID hit, it actually accelerated us because parents were really looking to find community online. And it's when our Facebook group of mostly moms kind of grew the most. And, you know, it still has almost 50,000 members in it. And they're just our diehard Slumberkins community where, you know, we know of 10 adults that have Slumberkins tattoos because the messages and the characters are so meaningful to them. And everyone was shopping online and looking for ways to support kids and tools and resources because you were all trapped at home and you really needed support.
Oh, yeah, 100%. And people getting tattoos with your stuff. That's like in business school, in case studies, when you talk about branding, inevitably Harley Davidson will come up and it's like, well, you know, what other brands do people get the tattoo of the logo consistently? And so like in my head, My MBA background says, like, if they're getting tattoos of it, you have nailed your branding.
We always put that in the decks when we talk to investors. And we're like, here's our tattoo page. And they'd be like, okay, this is real.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of legitimacy in that. I am curious about the way you approach social media and community engagement. You've got a Facebook group with 50,000 people. Just talk to me a little bit about how you interact with that community or think about it, or, like, you know, initiatives or programs within it.
Kelly and I stay very connected with that group. You know, they're really the diehard community that shows up for, you know, when we do lives weekly in there, just really wanting to stay connected and it also just show that we're just human. We're also in the trenches of parenting and figuring it out. You know, we might be experts in our fields of a teacher and a therapist, but we're also still human and moms. And I think that, you know, in the world of children's toys and education, you can't find brands where you can get access to the founders like we've kept it. And because it's just so meaningful. Another thing that happened where the community really showed up for us was when the Silicon Valley Bank crash happened. Our funds were tied up in Silicon Valley Bank.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah. It was, I mean, we had so Kelly and I were flying back from New York that day back to Portland. And I was, you know, we had requested that the funds be transferred out to a different bank, but they did not make it out in time until when it crashed. So when we landed in Portland, we didn't know how we were going to pay payroll the next week. And we had $0 in the bank. And we didn't know what we were going to do. And the board had done an emergency meeting while we were flying. And someone on the board had just said, in recognition of, as a board member, it's our fiduciary responsibility to think about wind down plans if this is bad, like if we can't recover funds and any of that. And so, but Kelly and I, as the founders, you know, you hear wind down plans of like your baby that you've built, like, and kind of go into like, oh no,
Silicon Valley is not going to kill us right now. We did not come this far to be,
to be killed by the bank. Yeah. So, we ended up like launching a sale because what we did have was inventory that we could sell to generate cash. So we ended up being very vulnerable and transparent with the community online and launching a sale and said, you know, here's a code. You can purchase with the code or you can purchase full price. Anything that comes in will help save Slumberkins because like we literally don't know what we're going to do. And in that one weekend where the cash was in limbo all over the place, we generated as much cash as we lost in the bank. So then we at least knew, I mean, the community literally rallied and showed up and like saved the brand that weekend. And then when we, you know, everyone eventually got their cash returned to them, you know, it really put us in a better position as a brand in this like economic climate to begin with. And the community was just so happy to show up and say like, hey, this brand matters a lot to us, and then organically share it with their friends and family, which is kind of what fueled the fire, because it's pretty crazy to me to think that even over that weekend, 60% of our customers were new customers, which means the community evangelized hardcore.
That's incredible. Yeah, that really does speak to the power of it, doesn't it?
Yeah. And it was really only because we were vulnerable ourselves, like not afraid to show our weakness, that then like people felt really compelled to like show up for us. And, you know, to this day, that was seriously one of the most impactful, meaningful things to have experienced when you like really have no idea what you're going to do.
Well, and I think too, just the difference of how we approached that shows, you know, that we're not business people too, because I think some of the business people behind the scenes who are part of our board or advisors, that there were people who were like, you should not have done that. You cannot show weakness like this to your customer. It's going to make you lose partnerships, like really came down hard on us. And I remember responding to that email and saying, look, we are here to promote authentic relationships, how to be in community and support each other. We're showing up and supporting them. And we're not just going to like grin and bear it when we're actually dying. Like, we're going to reach out to our community because that's how we work. It's reciprocal. It's open. We're in connection with them. So this is such a brand aligned move, and it's just authentic to who we are. It's not a strategic thing, you know? And I think that shift of like having businesses or women and just people coming and approaching things differently right now is, I think, such a nice shift to just maybe the old way of like look good at all costs so you don't lose any clout.
100%, you're right. And having that authenticity and that vulnerability, I think, works really well. But it is core to your brand and your mission, I think.
Yeah.
You know, that engaging in emotional intelligence and authenticity and candor.
Yeah.
Just fabulous. And okay, did you take a screenshot of the weekend sales and send it back to that person?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
They were fully aware. Yep. And I mean, it was one of those things where I think there was just, you know, conflicting perspectives. But at the end of the day, like, you know, no one can be mad when your community generates as much cash as you lost in the bank to put the company back in a safe position. And, you know, investors don't have to, you know, fork over cash they weren't planning to invest in a company in the first place. So it was just, it was all around a win-win. And actually, I think it brought us some partnerships. And I will say that we're still trying to untangle some of the data pieces, I think, because of the unique aspect over sharing to customers that might not typically be our target consumer. We have dealt with some like weird retargeting like algorithm things behind the scenes over trying to reach the right customers, like based on like if we're retargeting like lookalike audiences, that like something happened with that weekend with like from a retention standpoint that we still have lots of theories about and that we're constantly kind of untangling, but it's all a learning lesson, you know, in the big picture.
But I want to switch gears a little bit. And I want your reflective advice on a few things. So if I'm an entrepreneur and I want to get into manufacturing, selling something into the children's products market, and it's so saturated, what advice would you give me?
We'll probably both have answers to these questions. I would definitely do your research before launching. Like, we had an idea over what we wanted to do, and we did a lot of research on design, content, what already exists, and what would make us unique. And even before starting to sew, well, it was just a lot of online research, which kind of helped us even do our prototypes over how are they going to look different? How are we going to even be able to differentiate them enough to go get an IP, to go protect them as IP?
I would say, the thing that ended up helping us the most was from the get-go, once we knew what we were doing, believing in our product, believing in what we were doing, and making real connections with people, whether that was customers or people that we were going to partner with, it came down to relationships that ended up unlocking doors and helping us move to the next step, like one step in front of the other. Like the craft fair that we went to, I remember it felt like we were going to the NCAA tournament, packing up the van and like, you know, and we sold like 10 of them and we were ecstatic. We were so excited, you know? So it's like not letting your planning or thinking get over your skis about where you want it to go. Like, have your North Star of what it could be and be excited about that, but also be excited about every step, every person that you impact, every customer that you talk to. And what's their experience and what's their feedback? And we were really just authentically, that was how we were operating. And I think that's what allowed us to gain community, to gain the traction that we did, that then now we're able to really leverage the community. It's like the people who can show up and talk on our behalf and say how much they love it. Like, that's what makes partnerships happen. That's what makes the doors open to, you know, expanding what we have now.
The brand you have is very creative driven. So entrepreneurship, hard enough, then coupling it to creativity, well, like maintaining that creative vision, creative output is tough. Is there anything you do to stay focused as a creative entrepreneur or to stay energized?
Ooh, at this point in the journey, it's a lot of self-care and balance that we need to do, because both of us along the way have hit at different points, like 100% burnout of just kind of running ourselves into the ground. Because in the early days, when you have the opportunity to go on Shark Tank, you drop everything to like make sure you hit those deadlines to get on that show. Then when you have a potential deal with the Jim Henson Company, you do everything you can to like make sure that deal goes through, you know, like, and, you know, we sacrificed, and we also had new kids, new babies at home, where we were, you know, in postpartum eras, not taking care of ourselves in the way that we should be. So now down the road, it's a lot more about like, how do we actually like balance our cortisol levels in our system and be able to like show up and add the creative value that we do bring to the company. I would say Kelly and I split a lot of the kind of like creative vision, where Kelly's more over like anything children's, from like product or publishing, anything that's going to get in front of a child through a parent, Kelly oversees. And then anything that's like creative and branding and like communication, like to the parents, is kind of what I oversee. And that's kind of how we've split the different creative realms too.
I think that's smart, having so work-life balance for sure, self-care, and clear delegation of like who's responsible for what seems to be what has helped here, and being self-aware about it.
Yeah. And also stepping out of the normal day-to-day, you know, in this day and age, a lot of people are on Zoom calls all day long, and I don't know about anyone else, but it stifles my creativity. I think Kelly and I sometimes do our best work when we actually get outside and we're driving around, going on an adventure. We're just in conversation, and we really can have like an authentic conversation that leads to kind of a brainstorm, instead of feeling like, okay, in this next hour, we're going to brainstorm this, this, and this, and we're all going to stare each other on Zoom. Like sometimes that just doesn't work.
So in the last, you know, 8-9 years, you've really come an incredible distance. It's been quite the journey. 5 years from now, where do you think Slumberkins is going to be? What's your vision?
My hope is that we're on track or on scale with being the next, you know, Sesame Street for this generation, where we have the recognition across the globe. We have started that across the world with our partnership with Apple TV Plus, with our show. It's translated into 22 languages. But I think just that awareness and ability for us to help support changing the way we approach emotional health and wellness, and really looking at it from a systems perspective, so that we're supporting kids, we're supporting families. And when we are able to support mental health, mental and emotional health, the way that we did literacy or reading, you know, with Sesame Street back in the day, I really think that's going to change a lot of outcomes for the future generation. So my hope is that we're solidified in that position in the next 5 years.
I have faith, and I absolutely believe you, and I believe in you, because I know Yeti versus Elmo, Elmo's done. It's over. Right? That cage match. I think Yeti's winning against, I mean, is there any of the Sesame Street monsters that we're going to be able to take on a Yeti? I don't think so.
I mean, Big Bird's pretty huge.
Snuffle up, I guess, maybe, just by inertia.
Yeah. Snuffle up again. And I mean, Oscar can be pretty intense. I don't know. Our characters are so sweet. I don't know if they could handle his trash talk.
Maybe Hammerhead. Hammerhead, yeah. And Oscar would be a really fun like parody.
And on that note, where can we go to learn more about you?
Slumberkins.com, and Slumberkins is the handle across all social channels. And our Facebook group is called the Slumberkin Social on Facebook.
I'll include that stuff in the show notes. What an incredible story. Thank you for sharing it with me, Kelly. Yeah. And Kaylee. Just fabulous.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks.
And did you say you're
us.
Chicago-based?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Some of our biggest shareholder and investor is out of Chicago, Listen VC. I don't know if you've like met them or have interviewed more of their portfolio companies.
No, but I'll always take an intro.
Oh, yeah. They're great. And a lot of their companies are DTC focused. So, yeah, they're good guys out of Chicago.
Kelly Oryard, Kaylee Christensen, Slumberkins. Check it out, slumberkins.com.
Crowdfunding campaigns are great. You can add social proof and urgency to your product pre-orders while reducing risk of failure. But with traditional crowdfunding platforms, you're paying high fees and giving away control, all while your campaign is lost in a sea of similar offers. It can be frustrating. That's why we built Crowdfunder, the Shopify app that turns your Shopify product pages into your own independent crowdfunding campaigns. We originally created Crowdfunder for our private clients, and it was so successful, we turned it into an app that anyone can use. Today, merchants using Crowdfunder have raised millions collectively. With Crowdfunder, you'll enjoy real-time tracking, full campaign control, and direct customer engagement. And it's part of the Built for Shopify program, so you know it's easy to use. So say goodbye to high fees and hello to successful store-based crowdfunding. Start your free trial and transform your Shopify store into a pre-order powerhouse today. Search Crowdfunder in the Shopify App Store to get started.